3, 2, 1. That's Warden John Whitley getting a standing ovation from the inmates of the Louisiana State Penitentiary at Angola Monday at a going-away dinner which the prisoners gave to honor the warden. Whitley had been the warden at Angola since 1990. The proceedings were recorded by Fresh Air prison correspondent Wilbert Rideau, who edits The Angolite, the magazine of the Louisiana State Penitentiary at Angola, where he's serving a life sentence. We'll talk about the dinner after a break. This is Fresh Air. From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Yesterday, the Federal Reserve Bank raised interest rates for the 7th time in a year. William Grider says every time the Fed makes a move, there are winners and losers. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Grider about who they are this time around. Grider is the author of the book The Secrets of the Temple, How the Federal Reserve Runs the Country. Also today, our prison correspondent, Wilbert Rideau, takes us to an unprecedented dinner at the Louisiana State Penitentiary at Angola. The inmates chipped in to throw a testimonial dinner to honor their departing warden. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews The Wedding by Dorothy West, one of the surviving writers of the Harlem Renaissance. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Yesterday, the Federal Reserve raised interest rates for the 7th time in a year. That's big news, but it's news many of us don't really understand, even though it will probably affect our own finances. My guest William Grider says every time the Fed makes a move, there are winners and losers. He's been writing about the Fed for years because it controls the nation's supply of money and credit. Grider says it's the Fed, not the president, that steers the economy. Grider is the national affairs correspondent for Rolling Stone magazine, and he has an article about rising interest rates in the current issue. He's also the author of the book The Secrets of the Temple, How the Federal Reserve Runs the Country. Here's something a lot of people find confusing. The economy has been growing, which sounds like good news, but the Fed raised interest rates in order to slow down the economy. I ask Grider why the Fed wants to hold back economic growth.
A friend of mine who's an editor at Rolling Stone read these stories in the newspapers and the financial pages about how the economy is growing dangerously too fast. And he was genuinely puzzled. He said, "What's going on? How can this be happening?" And I said, "Well, basically the rich are running the country," which was a flip answer and too simple and slightly unfair to the Federal Reserve, but actually not wrong. I mean, what we are seeing is a drama that has played out again and again over the last 20 years, in which the Federal Reserve becomes the governor of the economy and decides really unilaterally that there is some hidden threat of inflation, that is price inflation, lurking in the healthy growth of the economy. And so this time, unlike previous episodes, They have taken a preemptive strike against that possibility. They are literally slowing down the economy, which is now running at about 4% real growth a year. Their goal is to take it down to about 2-2.5% a year. And their logic is that if you create a little more unemployment and you knock the edge off consumer demand sufficiently, then those dangerous inflationary pressures won't develop.
What are the dangerous inflationary pressures?
Well, this is even more puzzling, probably, to average citizens. The dangerous inflationary pressures, which do not yet appear in the American economy, but which they worry about, are rising wages. Most people, I think, have now read or understand in their own terms that real wages in the American economy have, on average, been declining for quite a few years. That is, you get your nominal paycheck, and it may be going up. But once you've deducted inflation and other things from it, you're actually losing ground. Your real income is subsiding. So, and that condition continues to this day, despite the healthy economy. So what they are doing is saying that's going to reverse dangerously, and somehow labor unions and individuals who can bargain up their wages are going to demand more, and that will put the squeeze on business, and business will then be forced to raise its prices in order to maintain its profit margins. And once that gets going across the whole economy, we have not 2.7% inflation, but 4 or 5% inflation, and pretty soon 6, 7, 8% inflation. This is a scenario that I'm not alone in this. A lot of economists think this is wildly, wildly improbable, and really recreating a fantasy from the past, namely the 1970s, when inflation did indeed accelerate out of control.
So on the one hand, the Fed is saying the economy is growing too fast. That could lead to inflation, so we're going to slow down the growth of the economy by raising the interest rates.
Yeah, and it works very directly. If you're, a young homeowner with an adjustable rate mortgage, you have already been hit a number of times. The Federal Reserve raised interest rates 6 times in the last year, basically doubled short-term interest rates, and they raised them again yesterday. And that goes, with a little bit of a lag, that goes right on your monthly mortgage payment. And I've seen various numbers kicked around, but my guess is that, nobody is typical, but probably somewhere in the middle range of homeowners, that's cost folks $1,000, $1,500, $2,000 a year. They don't spend that money on other things, and that's the effect the Federal Reserve wants.
You say that the Fed actually picks the winners and losers when the Fed creates its monetary policy. So who are the winners and losers, the way you see it, when the Fed raises interest rates as it's been doing for the past year?
Well, in big, broad terms, the winners are people who have wealth, savings, capital, who are the creditors in our society. They lend, and the rate of the rate at which they lend their money to others has just been increased quite substantially. The losers are everybody who borrows, and that's not just individuals, but businesses and other institutions that just in the normal course of existence, they're always borrowing and paying back loans. So you've just raised the toll for all of those people. I mean, in fact, that's what the Fed has in mind. It's literally to change the behavior of those borrowers.
I think the middle class probably has more invested in the bond market than ever before because of mutual funds and because of pension funds.
Well, I know that's the widely perceived as the reality. I don't think it's quite true. Let me give you some simple numbers, which are a little over crude, but still capture the picture. A Federal Reserve study of individuals and their financial wealth determined that 85% of the net financial wealth held by individuals, as opposed to banks or universities or whoever, 85% of that is owned by 10% of the families in America. Now, the other 15% is spread across what we call the middle class. But when you get to that still only gets you another 35% of the population. So here's the picture. The net creditors are those 10% of the very, very wealthy, another 35% of people with more modest means, and the other 55% of the families in this society are net borrowers. They're in debt. And so you begin to see the outlines of this transaction. And this is, there's nothing new in this. This inequality of wealth has existed for quite a long time. But the policies of the Federal Reserve reward one side of that ledger and penalize the other.
When we look at what a healthy economy means, and therefore what monetary policy should be, does a healthy economy mean something different, say, for a middle-class wage earner as it means for, say, somebody with a lot of investments? Does it mean one thing for a consumer and something else for the owner of a business?
It does. And the fulcrum is between those wealth holders, the bond holders and others who have long-term investments, whether in treasury bonds or corporate bonds or other forms. And they live in mortal fear of inflation. So they are constantly pounding on the central bank, the Federal Reserve, to be vigilant, to not let inflation even get started.
And what's their worry about inflation?
Well, in over 20 years, the value of their stored wealth will be depreciated if money is depreciated, so that you buy a bond for $1,000 in 1995 and sell it 10 years later and you discover that in real terms it's really only worth two-thirds of that or half of that because of price inflation. And this is the basic mechanism that keeps them always hyper alert to the possibilities of inflation. On the other side, inflation for wage earners may actually mean rising wages. They will also perhaps lose from the depreciation of money values, but in a very direct sense, they win from faster economic growth.
Because their wages go up.
Wages go up, there's more employment, there's more opportunity, there's more consumption.
And just explain for me how an increase in wages would also increase inflation.
Well, it doesn't necessarily increase inflation. That's the conservative view of the economy that the Federal Reserve embraces, but it's a very complex and disputed point. The theory is if enough people in the society, if labor markets become tight, then unions and others can bid up wages and demand higher pay, and then the employers have to pass that on, which means they raise their prices, and pretty soon you have a general inflation underway. One of the powerful counterarguments to that today is the global economy. It may have been true 30 years ago that the steel sector or the auto industry or retailers of various kinds could defend their profits by just raising prices unilaterally and setting off inflationary spirals. It's clearly not true today. There's a story in the Wall Street Journal today about the steel industry. They've got a healthy market going. They're selling a lot of steel. They raised their prices, and now they're stuck because imports from the global economy are flowing in at a faster pace, and they can't hold that price. That's the dynamic that the opponents like myself are trying to get the Federal Reserve to take seriously. Nobody in this economy, I won't say nobody, but most sectors of this economy are not free of those global pressures anymore. And that's a break on inflation which undermines all of the sort of historic logic of what the Federal Reserve does.
The Federal Reserve raised interest rates for the seventh time in a year yesterday. Is that unprecedented? Is that very unusual?
Not unprecedented. It's... I mean, at various times, the Fed has moved more cautiously and also much more dramatically. When Paul Volcker came to power in late 1979 and inflation was in double digits, he doubled the price of money in a matter of months. And it went way above the inflation rate. This time, what's unprecedented, I think, is that Greenspan and the Fed are acting without any evidence that there's inflation there. And they're saying, well, we can't see it, you can't see it in the statistics, but we know it's coming. The inflation rate last year in America, consumer price index, rose 2.7%. The same number that appeared the year before and the year before that. When you ask where is the inflation, they will say, well, there's some labor markets that look like they're tightening. But then you point to what's actually happening to wages, and the Labor Department put out a report just yesterday or the day before. The total labor cost, which is wages and benefits, was absolutely flat in 1994, and which is quite extraordinary given that the economy was growing at 4%. And many people, including the auto industry, argue that we're in a new economy now, where the connection between growth and consumer demand and wages just simply isn't the same as the Federal Reserve presumes. And part of that is the global economy. Part of it is greater efficiency in production. Part of it is the fact that notwithstanding what the unemployment numbers show, we all know all over the society, young people, middle-aged people, there are millions of Americans who are not, in their own terms, fully employed. And that's the labor that could be drawn into manufacturing or other enterprises as they continue to grow. That won't happen because the Fed is stepping on the brake.
William Grider is my guest, and he has an article in the current issue of Rolling Stone magazine about the Federal Reserve Bank. He's also the author of a book about the Fed called Secrets of the Temple, How the Federal Reserve Runs the Country. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with journalist William Grider. He's written a lot about the Federal Reserve Bank, including a book called Secrets of the Temple. Yesterday, the Fed raised interest rates for the seventh time in a year. One of your main points is that the Federal Reserve Bank is the real governor of the economy. It has a lot of power in creating our monetary policy. Who does the Federal Reserve Bank answer to when creating monetary policy?
Well, I think the most sympathetic way to describe the Fed is as a governing institution that's positioned midway between Washington and Wall Street. It is, in hard, concrete terms, it is not accountable to either. But in fact, it listens to both and tries to balance the noise it hears from both ends. Wall Street are the financial markets, which react to Fed policy and also hammer on the Fed governors when they're unhappy with monetary policy. And Washington are the elected politicians. What I have described in the last 15 or 20 years, that's quite different from earlier history, is that the Fed as a political institution has moved closer and closer to the Wall Street end of that seesaw, and further and further away from the democratic political end. And there are lots of deeper reasons why that happened, but that's why you're seeing this drama play out today, where financial markets cheer that the Fed is slowing down the economy. The real economy, Main Street, manufacturing, home builders, etc., are scratching their heads and saying, why are they doing this to us?
Well, the president appoints the head of the Federal Reserve Bank. Does the head of the Federal Reserve Bank answer directly to the president?
The chairman of the Fed consults with the White House and the Treasury on a regular basis, of course, and tries to stay on good terms with them, but really literally has the power to ignore what the president and the Treasury Secretary have to say about any of this stuff, and sometimes to go hard against the administration's own policies.
You say that the Fed is situated somewhere between the White House and Wall Street, and sometimes it listens to Wall Street even more carefully than it listens to the White House. What is the connection between the Fed and Wall Street? Why would the Fed listen so carefully to Wall Street?
There's several layers to that. The most obvious one is that the Fed, by feeding reserves into the banking system, has very precise control over short-term interest rates. And short-term means, say, anything up to 2 years, and whether that's treasury note bills or other forms of short-term credit. Long-term credit, particularly when you get out to 20 or 30-year bonds, is not independent of those processes, but is much more able to go its own direction. So that the judgments of the bond market, where those long-term interest rates are set, are like a constant critical review of the Fed's monetary policy. If the Fed cuts interest rates, for instance, and the bond market is upset by that action, it will push long-term rates higher. And Fed governors are loath to go against the bond market because it sounds like the financial mind of the country is giving them a thumbs down on their monetary policy. Now, that's a very simple example. Underneath that, the Fed is responsible as an institution and has been since 1913 when it was created to defend the soundness of the system. And that's the soundness of the banking system, but also more broadly the financial markets. So it takes up this responsibility and says, we have to do things in a way that keeps markets stable and doing the credit functions that they are there for, and also satisfies investors that we're not debasing the currency.
One more thing before we have to wrap up. You were one of the people featured on a public television show earlier this week that basically offered several critiques of the Bill Clinton presidency. And one of the things that you said, and I'd like to ask you to elaborate on this, is that although you may not share the politics of the Republican majority in Congress now, you think that the Republican control of Congress might lead American politics in a very interesting direction. And I'm just paraphrasing what you said. That is hardly a direct quote. But
right.
Let me ask you to elaborate on what you meant.
Well, I have said and written that it's easy for me to say this because I'm not on food stamps or I'm not in the gun sights of some of the reforms they want to make. But the Republicans are really putting back on the table some very fundamental questions about the nature of the federal government and really the nature of this society. I think a big part of their list, not all of it, but a big part of it is reactionary. I mean, quite literally reactionary in the sense that they would like to roll back to life as it was before the 60s or life as it was before the big government created by the New Deal became an important presence in American economic affairs. Nevertheless, it is simultaneously true that the Democratic majority in Congress had become quite rudderless and ineffective and was locked into sets of relationships of its own that were, if not corrupt, as Newt Gingrich claims, at least pretty decayed and worn out. And so I think it's not bad if we go through a really fundamental debate about the nature of all of these federal programs. The downside of that, of course, is that they are starting with the poor folks. And that's the easy part easy from their perspective. You can throw the poor people over the side, and especially we all know they're talking about the poor black people, but will you throw the farmers over the side? Will you throw the major multinationals over the side? Will you throw the wealthy taxpayers who enjoy fabulous tax deductions over the side? I mean, I think that's when the debate gets interesting, if they get that far. If they follow the principles of what they are articulating, they're going to discover that poor people are not the source of the federal deficits. Now, whether they blink at that point and stop or go on will be one of the critical moments.
William Grider, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
I enjoyed it a lot. Thanks.
William Grider is national correspondent for Rolling Stone magazine and author of the book Secrets of the Temple, How the Federal Reserve Runs the Country. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional funding is provided by Living Language. Learn a new language at home or on the go with Living Language. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Prison inmates and wardens are not generally known for their generosity to each other, so you'll be surprised to hear what just happened at the Louisiana State Penitentiary at Angola. Inmates chipped in to throw a testimonial dinner honoring their departing warden, John Whitley. Some of the proceedings were recorded by our prison correspondent, Wilbert Rideau. He edits The Angolite, the news magazine of the penitentiary, where Rideau is serving a life sentence. We'll talk about why the inmates felt so strongly about Warden Whitley. And critic Maureen Corrigan reviews the new novel, The Wedding, about an interracial marriage by 87-year-old writer Dorothy West. West was part of the Harlem Renaissance movement of the 1920s. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It may be hard to imagine the inmates at a maximum security prison organizing and paying for a going-away party for their warden. But that's what happened Monday at the Louisiana State Penitentiary at Angola. John Whitley, who had been the warden for nearly 5 years, resigned to accept a position heading a private prison in Florida. During his years at Angola, he brought education programs to the prison, corrected fire code violations, and perhaps most important, developed a reputation for listening to the inmates and treating them with respect. Fresh Air prison correspondent Wilbert Rideau recorded some of the testimonial dinner for us. Rideau is the editor of The Angolite, the news magazine of the penitentiary, where Rideau is serving a life sentence. In the past 34 years, he's seen more than a dozen wardens come and go, six of them in just one 18-month period. Rideau was one of about 100 inmates at Monday's testimonial. Most were leaders or representatives of prison groups. One security guard stood watch as the inmates, along with the warden and other prison officials, dined on bacon-wrapped hamburger, vegetable jambalaya, and ice cream in a room usually set aside for visiting. Rideau told me about the inmate who thanked the warden on behalf of the prisoners.
In staging this testimonial dinner, one of the more difficult things to agree on was who was going to actually handle the presentation. Who was going to MC the affair? Who was going to handle it? Because you had a lot of leaders who wanted to do it. And, you know, leaders as a rule have egos. And this, what we had to do was more or less agree on a sort of a dark horse, somebody who would everybody would agree on. And we finally agreed upon a guy who's he's a Vietnam veteran, and he's a maintenance worker in prison. He's not a president of any organization, anything, but everybody knows him, and he's a likable guy, and, you know, it resolved the politics.
Okay, well, why don't we listen to the comments that you recorded earlier this week at the testimonial dinner for Warden John Whitley.
Good afternoon. My name's Tommy Joyner, and I've been selected today to represent this group. We are here today due to respect, the ingredient that makes a prison run smooth. Prisoners are, as a rule, treated like children at best and as animals at worst. Warden Whitley played straight with us, up front and honest. That's saying a hell of a lot, because there are two things prison authorities can be expected to do: withhold the truth and never admit to being wrong. It's just such attitudes as that that led to the disasters at Lucasville, New Mexico, and Attica. Most of you will remember the strike here about the lethal injection table. We were standing on a bomb, and the fuse was burning. Warden Whitley, learning the truth of the situation, said, "Stop, hold it, we're wrong. They're right." Then he sat down with us to help figure out a way to defuse the situation. What other warden would have done that? Doing what is right is a trademark of his administration. A week ago, he summoned a contingent of prisoners to inform us that he had resigned. He didn't need to do that, but he did. He looked at us as men, not just inmates. We are sad to see a man like Warden Whitley depart, for he knows that respect is a two-way street. Fixing the food and arranging this meeting was easy. The hard part was figuring out what to give our departing warden. I'd like you to step up here for a minute, please, sir. George Woodcock and Norris Henderson are coming up here, and with them they bring a piece of Angola. Cut from an Angola oak and finished entirely by Angola prisoners, the presentation of this plaque is our way of showing our respect. It may be rough, but so is Angola. As we all know, Angola is no country club. The plaque is inscribed, "Presented with greatest respect to John P. Whitley for raising the standard of leadership, respect, and fairness to the limit of human ability." It is awarded by the prisoners of Louisiana State Penitentiary, January 30th, 1995. Thank you.
Of course. Just a few. This is really amazing. I cannot believe that the prisoners of a maximum security institution with their own finances have thrown a dinner to say goodbye to the warden. I've never heard of that being done before. And I can tell you, I really appreciate it. It's just something I never thought I would see. And I want to tell y'all, I thank you for this. I've tried to work with y'all to change the image of Angola and to change the way people looked at the people here at Angola. We did it with the traveling band. We did it with the drama club. We did it with the gospel group. We did it with a number of speakers who go out to civic organizations, to schools, and they see who you are. We've had documentaries done by the Angolite, radio, TV, showing Angola. And every time a group goes out from here, we get calls and we get letters. And they say, look, we want this group back, or we want this group to come here, and we cannot believe that these are Angola inmates. So you are changing the way people look at you. And that's something you have to do. This is something you're going to have to continue. People in the streets right now are scared of crime, and they have a right to be. They want to be safe in their home. They want to be safe in the street. But they don't know what to do. They're jumping at whatever solution they think will work. If it's lock them up and throw away the key, if that sounds good, then that's what they go with. But I think you find that more people are starting to come up here now, and we're talking professionals, to work with y'all, to work with this staff, to try to find a real solution, a real answer. And the only way you can do it is to work together. Work together among yourselves, work together with the staff. There's not a lot of groups out there that are running up here to help the inmates. That's not popular right now. So what you have is yourselves, and you have these people right here who actually know what's happening. And together, I think y'all can help come up with a solution. I've tried to give y'all the responsibility to go out and do something, to make something of your groups, of yourselves. And I think you've done a real excellent job at doing that. Again, I leave here grateful for this, and knowing that what I did because I thought it was right. I didn't do it because of politics. I didn't do it because of pressure. I did it because I thought it was right. And this dinner today makes me feel like I must have done something right. I appreciate it, and I wish all of you the best of luck. Thank you.
That's Warden John Whitley getting a standing ovation from the inmates at the Louisiana State Penitentiary at Angola Monday at a testimonial dinner they gave him. Whitley resigned after nearly 5 years as the warden at Angola. The proceedings were recorded by Fresh Air prison correspondent Wilbert Rideau. We'll talk about the warden's tenure at the prison after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Juan Whitley, President, Vice President of the United Methodist Men Fellowship, we just want to give you a certificate of appreciation. All the guys signed it over there. We just let you know you're being remembered.
I really appreciate it. Thank you. Good luck.
Juan Whitley, on behalf of the Forgotten Voices Toastmasters Club, we'd like to confer on you.
Joining us by phone from Angola is Fresh Air prison correspondent Wilbert Rideau. When Tommy Joyner presented the plaque to the warden, Joyner referred to a controversy over lethal injection at the prison that the warden got involved with. What was that controversy, and what did the warden do that earned the respect of the inmates?
Exactly what Tommy said. What had happened is that they had just executed a prisoner, And the previous night, the next day, there were a different division of the corrections department was insisting on having some prisoners in a tag plant build a lethal injection gurney. And, you know, that the bed that they execute these guys on. And they refused. And they insisted on doing it. And very shortly, you had a strike on. And SWAT teams were imported from, you know, throughout the state of Louisiana, and they all surrounded this place for about a week. It was kind of touch and go, and we more or less, Fall Park Purple was staring each other down over gun sights. And what happened was the warden dug into the situation. He talked to some prisoners. He found out what the truth of the situation was, and he called a halt to everything. He said, stop it. We're wrong.
When the warden said, we're wrong, what was he saying the prison authorities were wrong about lethal injection in general, or about asking the men to build the gurney?
They were wrong in trying to force those prisoners to do that.
To build the gurney?
Right. In fact, one of the guys who were being forced to build the gurney was one of the guys, his brother had been executed. And, you know, it was a moral stand by the inmates, and they just wasn't going to do it. And the warden decided they were right. You know, they shouldn't be made to do it.
Did the warden have a system of incentives and punishment that the prisoners responded to?
He did. In fact, when he came here, Terry, everybody was treated the same in prison. Now, a lot of people would say that's fine and good. But it's not. You don't treat people who are trying to do good the same way that people who do bad are being treated. That's wrong. And what he did was he created additional privileges for, you know, if you went without disciplinary reports for a year, well, he extended your visiting privileges, he extended your communication by phone privileges, because understand that short of freedom, actual freedom, the next most valuable thing to a prisoner is his access to the outside world and to his family and his loved ones.
It's pretty unheard of for prisoners to do a going-away party to honor a warden. Do you think that the inmates who participated in that party will be mocked by inmates who think of it as having brown-nosed the warden?
In prison, you always have you have the forces for good and the forces, and then you have the criminal forces. And I think that what took place in that room, it was a telling commentary about the maturity of the inmate power structure. It says a lot about us and about our ability to prevail over the more criminal and the more negative element that exists in all prisons. I think it is only possible because of the confidence and the strength of the forces of good.
So, so you see the luncheon as being a testimony to the leadership, the inmate leadership within the prison. Nevertheless, were there catcalls when the inmates went back to the cells? Catcalls by the people who didn't like the warden as much?
Well, to be sure. There are people who are going to look at it as, they were brown-nosing, you know, I mean, not like it. But the men who were there, and that's why I say it says a whole lot about them as well, is the fact that they were able, they feel confident that they are able to stand up there, do what they were doing, go back down in the prison population, and either there's not going to be any catcalls, or if they are, they can tolerate it.
The prisoners gave the warden a plaque. What was the plaque made of?
They wanted to give the warden something unique. They could have gone out and bought a plaque, but then it would be just like any other plaque. And they wanted him to take a piece of Angola. So what they did is they found a tree, they chopped the Angola tree down, and then they took a slab from that, and various inmates in various operations contributed to create a final product where it was a plaque. It is roughly made with the bark still around the edges of it. And there were screw-ups along the way, but we managed to get it. It went all the way down to the wire. It was finally brought up about 15 minutes before they gave it to the warden.
Yesterday was the new warden's first day. Does a new warden usually get tested by the inmates to see what their limits are?
No, not really. That's a myth among officials, but officials really believe that. And I'm certain he believes it. And that means he's probably waiting for it. But no, there's no real testing new warden. That's like testing God. He's got all the power.
Well, Wilbert, thank you for talking with us, and we'll talk again soon.
My pleasure.
Wilbert Rideau is Fresh Air's prison correspondent. He edits The Angolite, the news magazine of the Louisiana State Penitentiary at Angola, where he's serving a life sentence. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. What's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll have the latest from the Middle East summit in Cairo, where leaders of Israel, Jordan, and the PLO met with Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak. Also on today's program, a story about defense spending that isn't defense spending, that is, non-defense items in the Pentagon budget. We'll be hearing from a leading expert in veterinary dentistry on why you should brush your pet's teeth, and a demonstration of brushing a dog's teeth. And we'll also be hearing from Stephen Holtzman, who's the author of Digital Mantras.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Writer Dorothy West moved to New York in the 1920s to become part of the Harlem Renaissance. Now at 87, West has published her first novel in 45 years. Entitled The Wedding, the novel explores the explosive impact an interracial marriage has on a community of upper-middle-class black professionals. Critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
If there are any stress fractures within a family, a wedding will surely crack them wide open. And that's just what happens in Dorothy West's novel, The Wedding. Faced with the shocking prospect of an interracial marriage, the members of an upscale family of African Americans begin to break apart along the fault lines of race, class, and private shame. The Wedding is set in 1953 within an exclusive black community on Martha's Vineyard known as The Oval. West notes that the light-skinned Ovalites constitute part of blue vein society, so called because its members had sizable amounts of blue blood in their veins, injected in past generations by some passing senator or such. At the center of the Oval is the Coles family, whose youngest daughter, Shelby, is engaged to marry a white jazz musician. Shelby's snooty mother finds her prospective son-in-law's job more upsetting than his race. Her maternal grandmother, who's white, is delighted, while Shelby's father and sister accuse her of abandoning her people. To add fuel to an already combustible situation, there's a smooth social climber named Lute McNeil vacationing amidst the Ovalites, and he's determined to marry Shelby himself, even though, when the novel opens, her wedding is scheduled for the next day. As this plot summary suggests, West has a weakness for melodrama. Fortunately, the overwrought story of Shelby's wedding frames the book, but doesn't dominate it. For the bulk of her novel, West takes us on a marvelous excursion into the pasts of the Coles and other blue-veined families. We're told evocative stories about Reconstruction, the Great Migration, and Stryver's Row in Harlem. Here's how West gracefully evokes the era of the Pullman Porters. In this heyday of the railroad's prosperity, the parlor cars were the mobile drawing rooms of the rich, and the black men who served them as waiters or porters or redcaps received extravagant tips for their coldly calculated servilities. If he could stomach the servility, a man could ensure his future. Throughout her panoramic rendering of the rise of the black middle class, West keeps mulling over the mysteries of race and identity. What does it mean to be colored, her characters keep asking. It's an especially knotty question for the Ovalites, most of whom could pass for white if they wanted to. Maybe the most poignant answer is provided by Shelby's sister Liz, who says that being colored simply means you feel the hurt of it. Speaking as the last surviving member of the Harlem Renaissance, a movement propelled by pride and optimism, West asserts at the end of her novel that love conquers all distinctions of race and class. At that point, this fine book faithfully leaps from the genre of social realism to a utopian realm even more lovely than Martha's Vineyard.
Maureen Corrigan reviewed The Wedding by Dorothy West. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.